That was a seriously stupid thing to do, you know.
Ciao! Trovi la puntata sottotitolata in italiano su YouTube. I'm always looking for people that feels or felt strange, just like me. Doing that, I get the chance to talk with people from bands that I love, people that do things that I love, and today's guest makes no exception. Today's guest played bass in one of the most game-changing bands ever. A band that, instead of seeing punk as an unsustainable and self-destructive attitude for young people, interpreted punk as a conscious and sustainable and responsible way of life as an independent community. Not only they did say what they did, but they also did what they said. A beautiful example of sound research and ethics. I'm talking about Fugazi. And one of the many things that comes to my mind when I pronounce that name is their solid and amazing rhythmic session. Here's one of the many reasons why I'm so happy to be talking with Joe Lally, bass player from Fugazi. But Joe Lally also played and plays as a solo artist and with other amazing bands such as Etexia, The Messerics, and Koriki. So I'm very, very excited about this. Hi, Joe. How are you? And thanks a lot for being on my podcast.
Hello, I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great, thank you. So, first thing I always ask all of my guests is, have you ever felt weird, strange, different from the other people? And if yes, did it affect your music and the things you do?
Well, I can say that I definitely did have that feeling of separation, that outsider feeling, you know, growing up. And I have to say that as I got older, I think that I understood it better as a very typical feeling. I think everyone deals with it in a different way, but I think it is part of being a human being. There is this idea, and this, I believe, comes from the way we're raised and the conditioning we receive from everyone around us, the idea of our education system. There is something that doesn't ever address this fact about basically the human mind and the way our psyche works. There's something about the ego that tries to separate itself from everything. And in fact, it is, you know, an illusion that we either hold on to all of our lives or we become aware of it and understand that we're a part of everything and everyone. And we're not as alone as we think. So it having taken a long time to understand that.
Yeah, I bet.
I was not young when I began to understand that. So when I was young, I could only see how I felt differently than the people around me. So one of the first things that made that clear to me was my love of music, because I loved music that really was Black American music. I was listening from 9 or 10 years old. I began to listen very seriously to Otis Redding and James Brown, Sly and the Family Stone, and all kinds of R&B and soul and funk music. And I didn't have a community, or there was not much to account for Black America around me. I was in a white suburb, and even though my next door neighbor and I and another neighbor, we were all the same age, we had older brothers who were into this music, and we just got into this music this way, you know. So it was what we were exposed to through them, and it really had an effect on us because we really liked the music. So loving that and then kind of trying to understand that through my peers in elementary school was, you know, kind of the first time you look at the people around you and you start to go like, there's something wrong with this situation. You know, because you automatically develop a term like, you know, N-word lover. You know, you were that kind of a person if you liked that kind of music. So there wasn't many people to talk to about that stuff. And there was just no understanding of that. But there was Black radio that we could listen to, and there were shows that were happening in the afternoon that we could go see from the bands that we heard on the radio. So we went and saw the Isley Brothers and the Jackson 5 and
wow.
the Spinners and the Four Tops and the OJs.
Wow.
And those were all afternoon shows because they must have also done performances at night that I did, you know, I was too young to really know about anyway. But, you know, my next door neighbor's brothers were nice enough to kind of bring us into this, although we were so young. You know, mm-hmm. we were like 10 or 11 and we were going to see that stuff. So it was, you know, this was 1973.
Must have been pretty amazing.
It was pretty awesome to see. The venue, it was always the same venue that did the afternoon shows. And the stage was in the round. Mm-hmm. So the stage slowly moved.
Wow.
The audience was all around. My memory is that the building is not so big. And because I was not so big at the time.
Yeah, usually it's the opposite, you know.
It couldn't have been a large venue. Otherwise, yeah. my memory of it would have been different.
That's so true.
I honestly don't know how many people it held, but it was a fairly intimate experience and it was wonderful.
Wow, yeah, I bet. That sounds pretty wonderful to me, yes. And so what's the most, I think you partially answered already, but I'm going to ask, so what's the most precious thing you've got from this feeling strange? I think you partially answered because I guess it has something to do with music.
For sure, because it starts to make you question what it is about society that is not working for you, you know, because that's really what it leads to. If you really don't understand that, I am like all these people around me. I mean like all of the things you want out of life, that you want a new car and you want a house and you want to have a family. And I just didn't want those things when I was young. About the only thing that changed is that I did at some point want to have a family. But, you know, I could live even without the house, although I'm finally, it seems, going to buy what I hope is the very last house, you know, next month. We live in an apartment that we rent. But, you know, those things, and now, you know, I'm practically 60, so it really did take a long time to make a big difference. But anyway, it does make you question everything around you, I think. And at first I thought it was me. That's the terrible thing about this feeling of separation. Okay, just to be alive, I think there's a certain degree of a psychological separation. Because like I said, I do believe that, you know, you can read a lot of Eastern writing, a lot of Eastern philosophy and so forth. And, you know, Buddhism is probably like the type of thing that talks about it immediately. But there's philosophers that talk about this, that the ego is really trying to separate itself from everything. And it's the mm-hmm. nature of what the ego does. And so trying to understand that helps us understand ourselves better. And it's yes. something they should really teach in school. You should learn about your brain and why your mind works the way it does. But we don't learn that. Mm-hmm. So when we feel that separation, we tend to think it is us. Because if we really do feel separate, then everything seems to be against you. And in order to try to fix that, it can lead to some terrible solutions. For me, it was drugs. And I would take almost anything when I first started to take drugs. And then it slowly evened out to less experimentation. And I sat on some very particular things that I was just doing all the time. It was not good for my health, you know. It was not good for my mental health, and it was mm-hmm. not good for my physical health. But that went on for almost a good 10 years before I stopped. And really, it was music that I found my way out of that and into. And part of that was understanding that I had found a new community of people that did not seem to be completely set on self-destruction. I was very fortunate to find that. But it was within a music community that was not in my immediate community. I ended up going to many, many shows alone. I started out going to shows, you know, what would be considered punk and alternative music. Those shows from 1979 or possibly earlier, going to a local club and then actually seeing, you know, that's why I remember 79 as the first bigger bands that I really wanted to see. You know, those first shows was seeing Devo and the Cramps or the Clash. 1979.
Wow, beautiful.
But I was also seeing locally kind of what was just sort of taking place mm-hmm. in a couple of the bars, you know. Then that led, you know, to seeing more things. But eventually I understood what was going on locally to the degree that there were people putting out their own music. That took a number of years to understand because it was kind of 20 minutes, a half hour away from where I grew up in the suburbs. That was far enough to not understand what the local punk scene was.
Sure.
I went to see the Bad Brains, for example, play at a house party because they lived in this house that was used to have shows. But they didn't play that night. And because they didn't play, I didn't understand the music scene that was involved around them for another year or more.
Sure, because this was, of course, way before the internet and Spotify and YouTube. So, it of course, you needed to be there.
And I was in high school, so I wasn't, you know, I wasn't finding out things in the fastest way. And I wasn't meeting people at those shows necessarily that I stayed in communication with. That would take years for that to happen, where I would just start to talk to people I didn't know at the shows and get, you know, and actually then get to know what was going on maybe. By then, you know, I had already figured out other ways of doing that. So, yeah, it was really hard to catch up with everything that was really going on. It was my determination to just be involved with the thing that I did love, and it was seeing that stuff. So eventually I was going, you know, by 1984, 85, I was often just going alone to yeah. see shows. So I could only get people from my neighborhood, and then I didn't live in my neighborhood anymore by then. And I was just going alone because I couldn't get people to go, you know. It just became this solitary thing. And then it just turned into me getting involved with that music community. And really, because a band, Beefeater, took me out on tour as a roadie in 1986. That's what sort of brought me into that world and out of the people that I did know that I was a bit self-destructive, you know, with. And that mm-hmm. was mostly my own terms. It's just that if you don't find people who can get focused enough on something else, it's very hard to stop, you know.
Yeah, sure, sure. And so what's one of the most scary or dangerous things you've done as a child or as an adolescent?
As an adolescent, it was probably going to a party and consuming a bunch of pills. Before I would drink or smoke, I just took pills. And I had a friend who had, you know, a father who took painkillers. And then I had another friend whose mother had that sleeping disorder where they can't, so they fall asleep all the time. So she took a kind of amphetamine. And basically, I took both. I took a bunch of downs and a bunch of ups. And the next day, you know, I felt like I was half dead. But somehow I lived through that. But that, you know, it's those things that you look back at and go like, that was a seriously stupid thing to do, you know.
Yeah, that sounds so dangerous because you never know what actually happens inside of your body. That's all chemical stuff and that's crazy.
No, you don't. And even though they were prescribed, it's still ridiculous. I didn't know what I was doing, you know.
Yeah, but drugs are always like that, I think. You never actually know. You trust that somehow it's going to be fine, but it's actually something you never know. You cannot know how your body is going to react to that. That's just the reality of it. So talking about Fugazi, I think that Fugazi were all about moving forward and not accepting rituals. Keep pushing the dialogue, as also your bandmate Guy Picciotto said. And I feel like freedom, but still with clear principles, was the distinctive ingredient of Fugazi. So not fitting any stereotype, doing things your way, with your very own attitude and values, were like the basis of your approach to music. And it also allowed you to make something really new and unique. So, talking about feeling strange and different, did Fugazi feel like a rare bird in the music world back then?
Well, I would say that the band put itself in that place. I mean, we were trying to do something different. You know, whether we were that different in the end is for people to decide, but we were trying to challenge what was typically done. And we were trying to get our audience to challenge themselves. You know, that would be the way to look at it, because we really felt from the beginning, You know, we were a band that was made up of people who were known for other bands, except for myself. Everyone in the band had been in bands that had put out records. And we were asked in the beginning, you know, we must have played our first show by then with Brendan playing drums, but we must, you know, therefore had a name. Because somebody in Hawaii asked us to attend, you know, to be part of a hardcore festival in Hawaii. And I remember Ian discussing it with me and basically saying, you know, someone has asked us to go do this thing, but he's like, I don't even feel like we're a band yet. We just started to play. And here, you know, a festival, you know, it has that feeling of established. There's going to be a lot of people going, and the bands that are playing should be established bands. But we really, the both of us really had, I remember having that feeling of absolutely agreeing with him. There was no reason to do a show like that. And that is the type of thing, an example of just not everybody necessarily would say that. And, you know, to just say we're not, that's not something we're ready to do. And just kind of leave it at that. Now, the fact that we almost never played festivals as time went on was something that developed out of other feelings. But one of the original reasons to not say yes to that was just the fact that we just hadn't even become a band yet. You know, mm-hmm. We didn't have a feeling that we were actually a proper band. So we started from the bottom. So even though Ian was asked to play all kinds of things from the beginning, we really booked ourselves on our own. Ian was really the manager booking the shows. And they were in the size venues that seemed to make sense to us, that a local person could arrange a show for and sell the tickets for, and that it just wasn't a gigantic production. But we would try to bring people into a venue in that city, and it didn't have to be a normal kind of a venue or a club even. So all of that, like working that out from the bottom, it starts to set you off from the way somebody who, you know, another person who had been in a hardcore band like Ian wouldn't necessarily have done that type of thing, even at that time. So it just was kind of step by step and understanding what was right for us to do. So all of those things were, they were just very normal for the four of us to organize, but we definitely had an issue with the way we felt the music industry tended to chew up and spit out musicians, you know, mm-hmm. And we just didn't want to be a part of that. So in that sense, you know, I think you would have to end up somewhere, you know, somewhat different. Well, I don't think we were the only one. And so there was always other people who felt that way. But I mean, we almost always headlined because there were small shows that we were putting on. We're only conducive to how many people we would attract. That only moved like incrementally, very slowly over the years. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's not the same as a band who's happy to go do a show and actually just go on tour and open for a much bigger band. Mm-hmm. And then have this completely different interaction with a much larger audience who doesn't even know who you are. So we missed all of that. And that could have been normal for many of the bands that were our peers, you know, that were on our level, been around like we had been around. But yeah, so there was a lot of that we weren't doing. And by not playing festivals, we were missing out on meeting all of the bands that would be in a festival. That's a lot of bands. Just one festival would be a bunch of bands. So in a sense, yes, we were isolating ourselves to some degree. Looking back, it almost seems a bit odd, but it also kept us very focused on what we were trying to do. And it made it easier for us to be true to ourselves because we had to just answer to each other. There was no one else to answer to. And so the longer you do that, the more clear it is to the four of you what you want to do. So in one way, it's easier, but in another way, it's much harder for anything to change.
Yeah, but I also guess that people love you, especially, and also because of the fact that you made it to be yourself like the whole time. You never changed to be the band on a festival or to sign a record deal. You've been yourself from day one to the last day of Fugazi. And that's probably one of the reasons, of the many reasons why people love you and respect you, I think. So I love it, actually. And it's a very interesting approach to that.
Having done that, you know, was extremely, extremely rewarding, you know, to me on a, you know, just on a day-to-day level about like mm-hmm. trying to do something just to see that it can be done. that people are constantly telling you it can't be done. It's going to change. You're going to see that it's going to change. We yeah. had that said to us all the time. It didn't. It turned out that it didn't have to. So there's always some sort of something more to prove about it. And to continue to play with Ian today, where he is still interested in trying to figure out what that is very rewarding, because people are still looking at that as something that just had to change, and now it has changed and it's different and it doesn't mean anything anymore to worry about the price of a show, to think about this, that, or the other thing. But it actually is very, you know, rewarding to take those things into consideration and to not even charge money at the door, but to ask for a donation and just say what, you know, what you want to give and still see everything work out for everyone. The people yeah. coming in, the people putting on the event and the band, it still works.
It's still sustainable. It's still working. I love it. Since you were such a game-changing band, also musically, of course, I can't help but ask, should we believe those who say that there's nothing left to be discovered in music? Or do you think that young bands still have space for exploring and creating something new?
Oh, definitely. I always feel like there's something new to be discovered that you have to, you know, everyone's trying all kinds of things. You can tell just by the popularity of various types of music today. There's so much more variety in what's going on, people mixing culturally things. But you have to remember that the idea that we were musically different or that we were part of what you call a game-changing thing is for somebody else to say. When you are involved in trying to do something different all the time, then it's just an ongoing thing. The whole time we were in the band, we just felt that the next album had to be different than the last album. You know what I mean? It's just something that you require of yourself mm-hmm. to get on with what you do. And I don't always think that it was necessarily, you know, so wildly different. Of course, that's what we were trying to do. And hopefully there's something different, but I don't know. It was always us, you know, it always sounded like us. Hopefully we tried to believe that it was different sounding to people. It's really hard to feel that it's that different. I always feel that we still sat in tight in the type of music, whatever that was, that we were making. But it also inspired me as soon as that was over, that I was going to try to understand the music I was hearing in my mind, but I wanted to apply those things that we had done, that there was a spontaneity that mm-hmm. was held from show to show, that there was always something different that could happen, or you didn't exactly understand what was happening night after night. So that, you know, those things I kept trying to do with my solo music, and I keep trying to do with whatever music I'm involved with. It's just a way of seeing things, and you try not to define it too much.
I love it because, I mean, I love the idea of music as, I don't know, constantly looking for new solutions and always moving. And so I love it. I see what you say. I mean, you're still doing that. It's still your approach to what you do, and I love it. Fugazi's records are masterpieces, and in spite of being a band that took music seriously, as it deserves, of course, I'm sure that playing in a band that allowed you to do what you wanted and to break rules and stereotypes must have been a liberating and fun creational process too. And I guess that what you do now is quite the same. So was it actually fun and liberating? And which one of your records was the most fun in the making?
Well, it's very nice for you to say that our records were masterpieces.
I really think so.
It's a kind thing to say. I of course can't look at, you know, the music that I've been involved with that way. So it's very nice, but I should also acknowledge that I'm not answering to that and agreeing with you on that level because it's too crazy.
Yeah, and I know what you mean. I understand what you mean, but I really think so.
It's okay. I have to state that as an answer.
That's something I appreciate about you guys. So
I do have to say that it was, when it's a part of what you're doing, that it definitely, you know, it's keeping the challenge. You are always challenged to work harder. So that in itself is a kind of reward because you know that you were really trying to go somewhere that you hadn't gone before. Now, mm-hmm. these are hard things to describe in detail and what was different than where we went or go where are you going? You know, of course, those things are really hard to talk about, but to just try not to repeat yourself is putting something on the table to work hard, you know, and to try to get something different out of yourself. So that was always exciting to do, for sure. To be a band that didn't work with a set list was an exciting thing to do. To go on stage and not really understand what set of music you're going to play that night is an exciting thing and a wonderful thing to be able to do. But it really encompassed the years of the band as a whole. So whenever we did finish an album, it was always kind of like the best that we had done up to that point. So it was often kind of that feeling of, okay, hopefully this is something different for people. You know, so you kind of felt like maybe that was the new thing that you've done. Mm-hmm. So it was always the last record. Even now, I don't listen through all my records, so I can't say like that there was a record better than another record. So there's that feeling of the last record, the argument, just being the last record that felt like we had to do something different than the previous records. There's a little bit of the argument just being the last one that I had that feeling about. But I have to say that the point of, I think where we began to be comfortable with ourselves in the studio and producing our own records in the studio, that's probably where things really started to become super creative on another level, because we couldn't understand that until we hit Red Medicine. I think Red Medicine is where the experimentation in the studio just became like, the studio is the studio, and that song is going to be what it is live. And we understand what the song will be as we execute it live. But let's see if we can interpret it in the studio and allow it to be what it can be in the studio. We kind of got a grip on the fact that those are two different worlds. Yeah, so something's going on there maybe for the last, what is it, three or four records, including instrument, you know, is kind of different for me, but I like them. They're mm-hmm. okay.
Yes, they are. As you said, you also played shows, of course, and you actually played many shows all around the world. What were, and maybe still are, I don't know, your rules and suggestions for a quiet and peaceful life on the road with a band?
It's mostly that you understand each other. Really, I kind of don't want to be in a band with somebody I can't live in a van with. Or, you know, live in the same house with, because that's what it is in a band, is really to share a very intimate, you know, living space, whether it's a van or a hotel room or whatever. That's part of it. I don't really want to set out to do what I know you have to do in a band. So to have a peaceful life on the road is to choose the right people, first of all.
Yeah. That is very, very wise. And I think that being in a band is the closest thing to like being in a relationship or in a couple, you know, because you spend a lot of time and you take a lot of decisions with those people, you know, so you better choose wisely who you want to be, who you want to stay with and spend days and months with. So,
yeah, it's one of the families that you create after you leave your family. A band True. Is definitely one of those families.
Yeah, and that should be the way it works. That should be a family for real.
And then it's really the focus of the show. I mean, when I'm on tour, I really don't care about, I mean, not that I wouldn't go see the Taj Mahal or a very beautiful temple or something, you know. I mean, when I'm in Japan, I want to go to a temple if I can go to a Zen monastery or temple or something. But it's like, it is just not what I get to focus on when I'm on tour. I've accepted that. I save my energy to play. So when I go on tour, it's really about being focused on what it is to play. I have been rock climbing on tour, but I don't want to go rock climbing. Yeah. It's not the kind of thing I want to do. I don't want to increase the possibility of physical endangerment, because you just want to be able to do your best in playing, and you should be focused on what it means to be there every night and to be able to play. So that's a big part of it, you know, and that's why getting fucked up doesn't equate with being on the road. Although some people, you know, made a life out of it. I can't understand how.
Me too. Same.
Requires a lot of energy and work. Yeah. I don't understand how people do it.
Yeah, no idea. Yeah, that's so hard to understand for me as well. And yeah, I love it because it also means that you want to really do the best you can when you're on stage and you want to put all of your energy in the music you're playing. So I really love this kind of approach and how you take your audience and people coming to the show seriously and their time and their money and their trust. So I really, really, really love it. Okay, so if you had a time machine and you could go anywhere in time, where, or better, when would you go and what would you do?
You know, I don't think much about going back in time in my life. I definitely don't want to go back. And I would not be younger if you paid me to.
Me too.
But if I can get out of my actual experience, I think that I would probably want to see Thelonious Monk play. You know, I would want to see like Albert Eiler play and Julius Eastman and musicians that I really love, but especially like Sonny Chirac and sort of a lot Sun Ra, you know, all the different like kind of free jazz, that movement and sort of classic jazz things that were happening. I mean, I would just bounce around from show to show.
Wow, great. And yeah, still talking about music and time traveling, if you could go back in time and tour with one of the bands or artists you love the most as a young kid, what band would you choose?
Oh my God, yeah, to be able to, I could definitely roadie for Hendrix, yeah.
Wow. You'd be happy just being the roadie.
Yeah. Yes, having roadied for bands, you know, I often had that feeling when Fugazi would tour and we would play a bunch of shows with the band, you know, I would have that feeling watching a band every night. If I was on the side of the stage watching Shellac, like night after night, then I would look after what, if Todd needed something, you know, I remember he cut his finger once and we wrapped his finger in duct tape or whatever. And that kind of thing, you know, you just start to do those things if you understand what it is to roadie. It's partially to be in the band. You're more like a piece of equipment than being in the band, but you still associate that feeling with like, I'm part of this and I need to see. Mm-hmm. I need to see the next and the next and the next show. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there is a strong connection between you and the band.
Because you also learn that the way to see a really good show by a band is to see them night after night after night. They start hitting a run of getting better.
Yeah. You've been playing in bands since the 80s. And you've been also playing music as a solo artist and with several other bands beyond Fugazi, as I said, like Atexia, Messerics, and Koriki. Did your approach to music and touring change in all these years? And what stayed the same? What changed?
It's really just having a child and really being, even though we're a very small family, we're a family, and she's grown up now. She'll be 20 here. But that aspect of it is going to make you look at a lot differently to be away. And so a lot of touring, I would have a different attitude about it if I didn't have family, for sure. I would be able to set out and actually roadie for a band that mm-hmm. I really like. I may have done that if I never had a family. And just the work that you do with a band and what you try to do as far as touring. But, you know, it's really less, though, of the family, this feeling about touring that has changed. That has only changed because of the last year. I don't know how I feel about touring at the moment. I'm definitely not ready. It shouldn't necessarily happen. But everything kind of standing still for a while and thinking about how much waste there is from bands traveling around and touring, you know, which is kind of gross because that's what I'm a part of. And, but of course, you know, I'm not in U2. The amount of like plastic bottles that are basically used for U2 being on tour.
Wow. Yeah. That's like a whole city, I guess.
It's disgusting and something needs to change, you know, and everything that comes into play because a band is going to come into town. Those things just, they kind of drive me crazy because when we moved back to America from Italy, I got a job with a local promoter that owns a couple of clubs and books into a couple of other venues. They're an independent promoter in Washington, D.C. But just watching the work they do and stuff and all the waste that goes on, it's just kind of makes me sick and makes me feel bad about, you know, the thing that I love to do the most. And I often start to wonder, you know, like, does that mean I should just play locally? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I guess that's especially a problem with huge bands. Like you said, when you two go to a city, they probably will have like 60 people working for them, or even more, maybe more, for days building the stage. And that's a huge waste of plastic and stuff, like you said. So that's a totally different league, I guess.
It's really my problem, but, you know, that's who I have to deal with, me.
So, final question. So, I always ask my guests to suggest us a song, a book, and a movie. They don't have to be your favorite, you know, but just stuff you liked, you enjoyed.
I'm not even listening to many songs that anyone's singing on these days. I'm listening to a lot of instrumental music. If it was an album, I would have said Sonny Chirac. But as an individual, I would say Nina Simone and... I think it's called Do What You Gotta Do. So a book I would recommend, Irvin Laszlo, L-A-S-Z-L-O, Irvin, E-R-V-I-N. And I would say Science and the Akashic Field. That would be a favorite book of mine. And a movie, really fucked up movie that I've only seen once and that I will never watch again, is called Come and See. And it's a Russian film about World War II, and it's awful.
Okay, so thanks a lot, Joe, for taking the time for doing this.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to share it with your friends and loved ones, and check out my other episodes in English. I've been talking with so many cool people. I've been talking with Bill Stevenson from Black Flag and The Descendants, Gail Farina from Karate. I've been talking with Chris Leo from The Van Pelt, Tim Kinsella from Joan of Arc, Up in Jazz, Good Fuck, Laura Jane Grace from Against Me, Spike Slauson from Me First and the Gimme Gimmes, Sully Nego from Propaganda, and so many more. And also, if you want to support this project, remember that I've got some merchandise that you can check out on stranopodcast.bigcartel.com. And so, yeah, that's it. Thank you. Bye-bye.